Exploration Films, where curious truths and uncommon minds meet.
Welcome to the Exploration Films Podcast. I'm your producer and host, Steve Ryder. Today we're returning to First Love, a historic gathering of Jesus music pioneers. We'll hear part two of that audio special that was created for this film, and then afterwards, we'll hear from co-producer of that film and veteran music producer, Dan Collins.
Out of the chaos of the 60s and 70s exploded a new generation of long-haired radical Christians singing a refreshing new song the world had never heard before. Who were these Jesus musicians? What motivated them? Where are they now? First Love takes you away from the spotlights and the crowds to a secluded mountain retreat for an intimate reunion of Jesus music pioneers. Be inspired by their passion as they share their spiritual journeys and live performances of their music that challenged a generation. The First Love DVD Commemorative Edition is an extraordinary package. Two DVDs plus two compact discs, a 30-page booklet with artist photos and bios, plus an exclusive look behind the scenes of the making of this historic event. Rediscover your first love. Call toll-free 1-800-964-0439. Or better yet, log on to explorationfilms.com. Explorationfilms.com. One of the first artists to release a Jesus music album came out of the San Francisco Bay Area. Singer-songwriter John Fisher.
The amazing thing about that time is that Christian music was a new thing. It didn't have this... It didn't have any history to it. So it was like we could hold concerts and non-Christians would flock to it because the idea of Jesus music or Jesus rock was a, ooh, that's cool. That's far out. Let's go check that, man. You know, and we'd do concerts at Frost Amphitheater at Stanford University, and 5,000 people would show up and probably 4,000 of them were not Christians. And they just were curious to find out. So it was immediate, and there was also that sense that we really were singing to the world, which was what we wanted to do. That was the original vision, was to save the world with our guitars.
Love them in the morning when you see the sun rising. Love them in the evening 'cause he took you through the day. And in the in-between time when you feel the pressure coming, remember that he loves you and he promises to stay. Love him in the morning when you see the sun rising. Love him in the evening 'cause he took you through the day. And in the in-between time when you feel the pressure coming, remember that he loves you and he promises to stay. When you think you gotta worry, 'cause it seems the thing to do, remember he ain't in a hurry. He's always got time for you. So love him in the morning when you see the sun rising. Love him in the evening 'cause he took you through the day. And in the in-between time when you feel the pressure coming, remember that he loves you and he promises to stay with you. Remember that he loves you and he promises to stay.
Ah, 1960s was the most culturally explosive decade of the 20th century. Communism loomed large as the archenemy of democracy. A proliferation of deadly nuclear weapons by the United States and the USSR threatened the world with annihilation. And confrontations like the Cuban Missile Crisis brought those threats to the forefront. A new generation of baby boomers were in high school when President John F. Kennedy was shot dead. Those same kids were in college when Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. both found the assassin's bullet. They watched as their classmates went off to a controversial war in the rice paddies of Vietnam and came back in body bags or in mental turmoil. And they saw pictures of students just like themselves shot down by their own country's National Guard at Kent State in Ohio. By the end of the decade, America's youth culture was growing increasingly restless. Political lies and half-truths only served to widen a generation gap that was already pulling families, even the whole nation, apart.
The most prosperous nation in the history of the world.
Soon the prophets of protest were replaced by the high priests of psychedelia, until finally, despondent and hopeless, a whole generation of young people tuned in, turned on, and dropped out. The search for truth for blue-eyed soul artist Terry Clark began deep in the jungles of Laos and Cambodia. The war was taking its toll on him. Terry explains.
During those years that the Lord was getting a hold of people like Chuck Girard and Tommy Coombs and 68, 69, 70, 71, those were years I was in the military. I was in northern Thailand, up close to the border of Laos and Cambodia, kind of in the boonies, in a listening station there. And had gone through some real traumatic changes. There was also this breaking inside. Jesus said, "Terry, I know how you feel. You know, I've seen everything human beings have ever done. But I want you to understand the difference in our response to that. You've decided not to be a human being. And I decided to become one." And where it had said no hope before, it said recovering satisfactorily.
Oh, let's have a good time. What makes you have a good time? Let's have a good time. What makes you feel real fine? Maybe the last time we get together here on earth. So for heaven's sake, let's have a good time. Well, let's have a good time. Put a big smile on your face. Let's have a good time. Girls sing tenor, boys sing bass. Maybe the last time we get together here on earth. So for heaven's sake, let's have a good time. Let's have a good time.
As a Grammy Award-winning producer, arranger, and keyboardist, Michael Omardian's work has been showcased in over 350 million albums worldwide. His faith was also shaped by the Jesus music of the era, and his talent touched many of those early recordings. Here's Michael.
I think cynicism came into my life when I was in my late 30s. Today I feel like people enter into almost anything as a cynic. Our young kids are just have been bombarded so much with so much corruption that they enter into any experience with cynicism. And I think the beauty of what I see in this video is not only my personal connection, which I try to say, okay, if I'm not personally connected to this, what is my reaction, which is hard for me to speak on because I'm personally connected. But there's a purity of what I view on this video that is real. And what it is, it's devoid of cynicism. It's devoid of some kind of theological argument about one piece of biblical evidence. It doesn't have any of that as part of it. It is just a pure statement of what it is to have a relationship with the Lord. And the music is just reflective of it. I think that if you sat and talked to those people and didn't hear them ever sing, you'd still pick that up. It's not just the music. And I think for a kid who's watching this video to get beyond the MTVism of life and the soundbite and the attention deficit disorder of our world today and spend a little time and get inside of what you're seeing and get a calm and a peace from what you're seeing, you'll come out with some rich experience here from this video with people who you look at and go, gosh, aren't they old? But they're really not, you know, and I think that that's the beauty of what you're seeing.
The Jesus movement seemed to have a mind of its own. No one saw it coming, and no one knew where it was going. Many explained it simply as the Holy Spirit's work alone.
At that time.
Pastor Jack Hayford.
There were two qualities present at that time that I wish could be equally recovered today. The first was an unapologetic, simple, open availability to the full workings of the Holy Spirit without doctrinaire debate. The second thing was a truly precious simplicity in worship.
Here's Matthew Ward singing to the King alone.
To the King who gave everything for me, whose body crucified high on Calvary's tree, whose redemptive blood makes way for me. I now give everything to the King who came in the form of a child, a powerful God, and yet so mild, whose obedience shows the way for me.
Chuck Girard looks back at the whole experience of first love.
Well, it was really historic. I mean, it was what a wonderful opportunity. I mean, many of us hadn't seen each other for like 25 or 30 years. Using Nancy Honeytree as an example, the last time I saw Nancy, she was this little hippie on a stool playing her guitar. And 30 years later, you know, she's Grandma Nancy. And, you know, people like Barry McGuire and Nancy Honeytree and those early people were faithful people that wanted to serve God first. That was really First Love is a beautiful name for that project because that's really what it was. It was about Jesus first and fond memories of many of them. This was like a really special time where it was really quite moving. You see that on the tape. I mean, it was just highly emotional seeing these people and then reminiscing for the first time that many of us had even really been in a room for so many years, and maybe ever for some of us. You know, it's just completely selfless and loving, the whole gathering, and just seeing how people, you know, 30 years later, how people responded to one another and the affection and the respect in that room every night. I think we filmed for about 4 nights, and it was just amazing. And I think that the power of that shows through every minute of the production. I think it's so powerful. I have heard so many people just say that they can't watch it for 10 minutes without just crying because it's so powerful and so anointed. It's not just the emotion of memories of the past, it's the power of the stories being told and the power of the moment, really. It's partially about the past, but it's very much about the present.
When Midwest folk singer Nancy Honigbaum found Christ, she began writing songs about her newfound faith and became known simply as Honeytree.
I'm just completely grateful and blown away that God allowed me to be a part of contemporary Christian music in the early 70s. To be included with a group of people like Second Chapter of Acts, Barry McGuire, Randy Stonehill, Randy Matthews, these people that were legendary to me when I got saved. And suddenly my name was mentioned with theirs, and I began meeting them as I sang in festivals and things. And we became friends. But just to be a part of that time when God was bringing a refreshing to music, which has now just blossomed into an incredible flood of Christian music that people are enjoying today. So, you know, I'm grateful that I got to be a part of that. Realizing that you still have a frontier to reach of your own, that God calling is still on your life. You still got to go for it, regardless of whether people recognize you for what you've done or what, whether they don't.
Pioneer, pioneer, keep pressing onward beyond your fear. Only the uncharted wilderness stretches before you, and you thrive on going where no one has gone. Still it gets lonely when darkness deepens, so sing by the fire till the dawn. You travel light, you travel alone, and when you thank you. what you have done. Others will do bigger and better and faster than you, but you can't look back. You gotta keep pressing.
Cal Thomas is America's most widely syndicated political columnist. Cal explains how he was exposed to the project.
Well, Nancy Honeytree and her husband gave me a copy of it. I get a lot of things on the lecture circuit and in the mail because of my column and being on television. And a lot of people mean well, and they give me things that's usually bad. I mean, it's badly produced. It's just bad. And I, you know, with all due respect, don't have time to watch it or listen to it. But because I've admired Nancy Honeytree for so long and her music and her gift and her charm and her grace and finally got to meet her many, many years after the 60s, I said, well, I'll take a look at it for 2 or 3 minutes. Well, it wasn't 2 or 3 minutes. I watched both videos. I sat there completely transfixed and transformed. I was in tears by the end of it. I mean, it just deeply touched my heart. It is one of the finest things I have ever seen to come out of the Christian music industry. And anybody who lived through that period, and even anybody who didn't, who wants to know what was the Jesus movement and why was it important and what kind of depth did it have that would take so many people who were into drugs and unbiblical relationships and into despair and so radically transform them. Some of the music that came out of that period is the finest ever written. I don't think there's been a lot of stuff that is as consistently good time after time since then. I just think this was inspired music, and it continues to play in my head and in my heart even today. It's a wonderful video, and the stories and the historical film that is in there, which helps set this music and the people who wrote it and sang it in context, I think is a very important addition to the video. I'd highly recommend it. I love it.
This aspiring young rock and roll singer was featured in Time magazine, calling him Decca Records' prepubescent dreamboat, and wondered whether he or a young Donny Osmond would capture the attention of preteens and teenagers. But this singer's life would take an altogether different direction, as later in life he would touch an entire generation for God, as the legendary Christian artist Keith Green.
Someone like you care for me, you put this love in my heart. I tried but could not refuse. gave me no time to choose. You put this love in my heart. I wanna know where the bad feelings go when I'm depressed and I get down so low, and then I see you coming to me and it's alright.
Keith was tragically killed in a plane crash, but his life and musical contribution would be remembered at the First Love event. His wife, Melody, recalls the first time they heard the gospel.
We were really spiritually searching, both of us. And that was one of the things I was really attracted to in Keith when I met him. Even though we weren't Christians, he had a real hunger for God and for truth, and he was very spiritual. I felt a connection with him in that area. So we went on a search together, and he was reading about Jesus and reading the Bible. And then through his music, we met some Christians. The first one that we met was Randy Stonehill. He was playing at the same little club that Keith was playing at, the Blah Blah Cafe. And Randy kept bugging us to go to some Bible study with him. And it took us a long time to actually get around going. But we finally did, and that happened to be the very first little vineyard church in Ken Gullickson's house. And so we received the Lord there. I heard the gospel really for the very first time. And Keith had a Jewish background and was raised in Christian Science. So he was the first one to get saved and raise his hand that first night when Ken explained everything. I think the same thing got to both of us, and it was that we could start with a clean slate. Jesus could really forgive our sins. We had been into all the Eastern stuff and, you know, metaphysics and, you know, everything. Both of us, separately and then together, looked into that, and nobody really gave you that kind of clean slate. Ken was sharing that night, Ken Gullickson. He just unfolded the love of God and how he wanted us. And how he could bring us in and embrace us, and we could be cleansed and forgiven and have a new life.
Giving us your son and leaving. Out of the chaos of the 60s and 70s exploded a new generation of long-haired radical Christians singing a refreshing new song the world had never heard before. Who were these Jesus musicians? What motivated them? Where are they now? First Love takes you away from the spotlights and the crowds to a secluded mountain retreat for an intimate reunion of Jesus music pioneers. Be inspired by their passion as they share their spiritual journeys and live performances of their music that challenged a generation. The First Love Commemorative Edition is an extraordinary package. Two DVDs plus two compact discs, a 30-page booklet with artist photos and bios, plus an exclusive look behind the scenes of the making of this historic event. Rediscover your first love. Call 1-800-964-0439. Better yet, go to explorationfilms.com. Explorationfilms.com.
Steve and I have talked about, he apparently owns JesusMovement.com and has just been sitting on that for years. And he's kind of said, I want to do something with these voices while they're still absolutely here and while they still have their memory.
Well, he and I talked this morning about it just because I said, you know, Steve, with all this stuff coming out right now about the Jesus movement, this new film that's come out, which really is not about the Jesus movement, but it's about Jesus music. But that encapsulates, they've tried to reach back and talk about stuff that happened during our time, but none of those people were part of it. So
yeah,
it's a little silly. But I haven't seen the movie and I don't intend to because I'd rather not be critical. And it's better for me just to not do it.
Yeah.
And you know, there's probably things I'd really like about it.
Yeah.
But I've heard so much criticism already about it from people my age that are going, this is not about the Jesus movement or about real Jesus music. This is just about what happened in contemporary Christian music after that. So I said, okay, well, yeah, if you want to see something that talks about the Jesus movement, then go to First Love, you know. That's where you're going to find it, because that's what Steve and I intended to do was to. And in fact, I'll just back up so that you get the story. I had Jamie and I, my wife, who was a recording artist for many years. We traveled around and all over the world doing concerts and ministry. And one of the things that I noticed in the churches, because we went to every kind of possible church you can imagine, and we saw Jesus in all those places, which was awesome. And we brought Jesus to those places.
Yeah.
Was there were many people that were our age who came up through the Jesus movement that really didn't remember or understand. They've kind of all got into business and made their money and did what they did. Now they're just sitting in pews. But back in the Jesus movement, they were active. They acted out their faith. Yeah. They were alive. And now many of them just saying, what's going on? Is the Holy Spirit even around anymore? I mean, we're not even sure what's going on. We don't have any sense of that like we did during the Jesus movement. So
what do you think caused that? What do you think was the impetus behind being active and then suddenly just sitting in the pew? And
because the Jesus movement was so vibrant, there was just something going on that the Holy Spirit was doing that none of us had control over, but we saw it every day. And we saw and we were compelled to act. It was very interesting what was going on.
Do you think that compelling desire, was that just because you were young at the time?
Part of it was because we were young and this was new, and we were seeing Jesus bring people to a real recognition of their own lives and what they should do with their lives and define Jesus through LSD and drugs. And this had nothing to do with the church. The church was not involved. The church was just doing its thing. And these kids on the streets were coming to Jesus. And everybody's going, what's going on here? So there were a few churches in Southern California where that would open their door to these people. And Chuck Smith was one of them. Ray Steadman was another. Jack Hayford was another. And they were open to seeing these young people who were living on the streets or just living in communes at that point, who had come to Jesus, who really had this heart's desire to want to serve God. And they opened the doors to them. A lot of the churches said, they don't wear shoes, they're dirty, all this stuff. And we don't know how to deal with that. And I don't think they were opposed to it, and other than the fact that it was such a different way to look at things that they just didn't feel comfortable. But there were a few pastors who said, you know what, if this is God, you know, we need to open the doors to these young people. And after a few conversations, you see, wow, there's some serious people here who love Jesus and they really want to do something. How can you keep them out? You know, that's not right. So what if they don't look like us? They got long hair, they're, you know, whatever. So that was good. There were some really good things that happened as a result of those pastors who felt compelled to let those people, young people, in. So I think from that standpoint, there was a revolution that was happening and everybody knew it. No one could stop it. No one could change it. It was just happening. So either you get on board or you don't, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And for someone like me, who's a preacher's kid, you know, I didn't grow up as a hippie, but I went to Vietnam. So yeah. I was in the war. And when I came back out of the war, I went over there in 68. There was a radical change that was happening when I came back and saw, you know, these young people.
How long were you over there? When did you come back?
I came back in 69, the end of 69.
Okay.
Went over in October of 68. So when I came back, I could see something was really different. You know, something had changed. And I started recognizing that there's a whole different kind of music out there that's going on. And I was seeing different artists who were secular artists come to Jesus. And I was working as a booking agency at the time and booking bands into schools and colleges and clubs. And I, you know, even though I was a preacher's kid, I had, you know, I walked off the road for a while, so to speak.
Yeah.
But then I, you know, there's a long story that goes on with all that, which I don't know if I want to go into all that. But in the end, I ended up saying, you know what, I started working with an artist who said, you know what, I'd like to have you arrange the vocals on my album, because he heard me sing and I sang with him at a concert. And he said, wow, this is awesome. And he was in the middle of an album. Name was John Fisher. Okay. And so I ended up moving to California from Seattle to the Bay Area. That's where I really came in touch with the Jesus movement. And John was recording and I started working on the vocals, arranging the vocals for the album. And then I became the co-producer of the album, which I really didn't even know what that meant at the time. But I was so excited to be at Sound City Recording Studios and sitting there with Keith Olsen sitting next to me, who was, you know, just putting together Fleetwood Mac. I was like going, man, this is it for me. I mean, this is home.
Yeah.
And so Keith actually started teaching me how to record and how to get involved, because I was so enamored with the whole studio. I didn't want to leave.
Yeah. Really?
And yeah. And so he was teaching me how to record. I was learning how to, and to produce, how to make music happen in the studio. All that was happening at Sound City, which is, I don't know if you've seen the movie that Dave Grohl did, a film called Sound City, a documentary.
Okay.
It's pretty cool, because that's when Nirvana came down from Seattle and they got involved. That's the first studio they went to, because they knew that's where all the rockers were. Well, guess what? I was doing Christian music in there as well. So that was kind of a mind blower.
Yeah.
But Keith, you know, music was music to him. He didn't really care what we were doing. He loved what I was doing, and he really helped me get off the ground with understanding how to record, how to be in the studio, how to act, how to work with musicians, how to work with studio musicians. It was fantastic. It was really, really good. So all that to say, I could see what was happening in Christian music, because there was just the beginnings of that. It was 1972 when I first started working on records on Christian music. And I could see how these artists were beginning to develop their Christian music writing and style and what they were singing about. They were telling stories about their lives. It wasn't worship music. They were actually writing about, what is my life about? And now that I've become a Jesus person, or a Jesus freak, as they were called back then, how does that change me? What is my life like now? Yeah. So these songs were all very encouraging about how to walk in life with Jesus. So I'm going to get off track, because if I start down a road, I just, you know, I'll just barrel down it. So hone me back in.
I will when needed.
Yeah. So I started to see people on the streets that were now Jesus people that were coming to the Lord. And I was involved in a couple of different churches. I was living in the Bay Area, so I was really close to Haight-Ashbury. And I went up there and saw what was going on. And then one of the guys, that his name was Ted Wise, and he started the first Christian commune up in San Francisco at Haight-Ashbury. He ended up coming to our church at Peninsula Bible Church, where Ray Steadman was the pastor and several other pastors, Ron Ritchie and Dave Roper and a few others. And Ted was like, all these people are coming to Jesus, you know, and on the streets in Haight-Ashbury, you know, they're doing drugs and now they found out what real life is about. They were looking for, you know, real love, and they were looking for, you know, how do I live my life? I don't want to be in this system that's out there. I want something different. I want to find out what peace and love is all about. Mm-hmm. Well, what they found was drugs and sex. They didn't find peace. They didn't find real love. And that's why the Jesus movement happened. Jesus saw that. And the Holy Spirit went in there and said, okay, I'm going to reveal myself to you. When you're doing LSD, you're doing these drugs, whatever, and thinking about free love and all this, I'm going to let you know who I am. And I had so many people tell me that during an LSD trip, Jesus came to them.
Wow.
And it changed their lives. And then all of a sudden, people are getting saved like crazy on the streets. You know, this is how this whole thing happened. It didn't happen in the church, you know. Yeah.
I guess, what does a pastor who went to war in World War II, or even was in World War I, how do they handle something like that? Jesus came to you in an LSD trip? Yeah, no. I could see where the resistance...
Yeah.
Would come from.
Yeah. You can see where there would be some kind of a, wait a minute, this is not how we've seen Jesus work in the past.
Yeah.
So what you're now telling us, that someone isn't preaching to you and bringing you to Christ? No, no. I found Jesus in a drug infused environment, you know, and then all these kids are getting saved. And then Ted Wise sees that and he says, man, we got to get these kids together and I'm going to start a Bible study, you know. So that's how a lot of that started at Haight-Ashbury. So I'm there. I'm up in the Bay Area. So I'm really in seeing all this stuff happen. I didn't come out of that environment, but I still had to come to a place where I went, yeah, I'm going to follow Jesus. This is it for me. I'm convinced. Mm-hmm. You know, that this is the way that we ought to live, because Jesus had the right answers to everything that I had questions to. So I think what then took place was, I'm seeing that happen in Haight-Ashbury. I'm seeing that happen in the Bay Area. And I'm working on a Christian album from an artist who also grew up in the church, but he's very well aware of what's going on, mm-hmm. you know, in this Jesus movement thing. So yeah. He's writing songs that are really helpful. And so then I start recording with him, and then this is it for me. I'm going, okay, well, if God allows me to, I want to make records. I want to take these artists and really do what I can and do the best I can with them and try to get their music out, because God's telling them stuff, you know, and how can I support that? And I believe that that's why Christian record companies started, was how do we help support these artists that Jesus is talking to? And helping them understand what life is about. Unfortunately, after time, it kind of switched. And then the record companies kind of took control, because they were making money off these artists. And then they started dictating what they wanted to record and how that artist should record, rather than the artist needs to hear from the Lord.
Yeah.
So yeah. That changed the environment after time. All that to say, I got to make a lot of records. I got to get involved with a lot of artists and be involved with their lives. And that was fun, including my wife.
How did that change of the artists being in control of the artistic expression to the record company exerting more control over that artistic process? What did that do overall to the scene?
Well, it forced artists to try to write songs, because the record company needed more songs and needed more album projects from that artist so that they could build their company. So it wasn't about just supporting the artist anymore. It then became, you need to support our machine, which is the record company. Mm. So all of a sudden, we had a couple artists, and now they're no longer going to be a part of the label because they're not making enough money. That's not why we signed them to start with. I mean, mm-hmm. we signed them as a partnership to say, we're going to support your ministry. Mm. Now it became business. Mm. And the business was now dictating the ministry. So that's what changed. And that's how it changed. And as a result, then the record companies became very wealthy, some of them. And many of the people became wealthy. And the artists kind of got shoved off to the side if they weren't making enough money. So their popularity had to be based on marketing, radio promotion, concerts, and all this stuff. And so the record companies know the importance of getting those artists out there, because the more exposure they get, the more they're going to get fans and the more money they're going to make. And so if that's not happening as much as they want, then that changes how the record company looks at the artist. Mm. So I literally started a record company actually with Second Chapter of Acts. So Steve was involved, and it was called Live Oak Records. And I started that by myself initially. And then Buck Herring called me and said, Dan, we'd like to join you. And we were all part of Sparrow Records at the time. And I said, well, I mean, you know, you're with Sparrow. What's happening? He said, well, we're kind of moving on. So I said, well, let's talk about it and see if there's something we should do. So we my family, the Jimmy and Carol Owens, Jamie's mom and dad, and Jamie and Jamie's brother, Buddy Owens, and then the Herring group with Second Chapter of Acts, and Barry McGuire and Terry Talbot from the Talbot brothers, and John Michaels, his brother, and who I'd produced projects for all of them, you know, at some point, not Second Chapter, but Barry McGuire. And so we kind of just put together a group and did a distribution deal through Word Records out of Texas. So we had that label and tried to get back to that idea of let it be an artist controlled record company rather than a record company controlled company. Mm-hmm. So that was our idea, to try to keep things moving. And we actually had gone through a whole time where we actually put out a letter to Christian media and said, don't try to put us in order of who's best in the kingdom. You know, who's the better artist. We don't want to be compared like that. We don't want to have, you know, who's number one. I mean, I remember when one of the Christian magazines came out with who's the best ministry of the year? And we were also offended by that, because, like, how do you become the best ministry of the year? What criteria are you working from? Tells you that this is the best ministry, and who's choosing that? You know, it just seems so silly. And so a lot of the artists got together and said, you know what, we really don't want record charts either. You know, I mean, why is that the number one song? What if actually nobody's being ministered to by that song, but everybody just likes the groove? But what about that song that isn't even on the chart that is changing people's lives?
Yeah.
So what is now the criteria for whether it's a good song or not? You know, it may be a good song, may not be a good song. You know, it just turns into a whole scene. So a lot of the artists were trying to say, look, we get up and we did this in First Love, and then I'll get on to the First Love and how we got that happening. Why in the world do we choose the songs we choose, and how do we think it's going to be most effective for the kingdom? Are we now making songs for the radio to see if we can get hit songs? Or are we making songs that we believe Jesus told us to write? And I say that, you know, because obviously he uses human beings as vessels, and you need to be a songwriter to be able to write a good song. You just don't get a song from no reason.
Yeah.
It's giftings and skills and all that go with it. But what becomes the criteria for what we do and how we do it? So I realized that there was a lot of great music coming out, and we were involved in that. Jamie was putting out some great stuff, and different artists were putting out great stuff. And then getting back to the point that we were making a lot earlier, how did we get to the place in the church where when Jamie and I were traveling, we saw that a lot of these Jesus people were just sitting around doing nothing, you know? Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were very confused. And I thought, you know, how do they get refreshed? How's God going to take who they were back in those days? And so I didn't really know what in the world I was thinking about. And I had a dream one night. I started dreaming and God woke me up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And he said, you need to get these artists back together. And the artists that were around during those early days that these people remember and love, and let them tell their stories of what God's been doing over the last 30 years. Cause it had been 30 years now since that period of time. Yeah. I think we did it in 1998. So I thought, wow, man, that's, and specifically to 2 points. One, remind them of their first love. Remind them that they love me and what that means to them and what it meant to them then and what it means now.
Yeah.
Number two was all their kids have no clue what happened during the Jesus movement or why their parents are the way they are or how they came to Jesus.
Yeah.
Most of them. And so these two things were part of that 4 o'clock in the morning experience. And I woke Jamie up and told her, I said, look, I just had this incredible download and I think we need to act on it, you know? And so the next step was trying to figure out, okay, now what am I going to do? I know all these artists. I've got relationships with most of them over the years. I've recorded several of them. So how do I get them all together, you know, and who do we pick and how do we make this work? So at that point, I got a hold of Steve, and Steve and I obviously been friends for a long time and worked together in the Live Oak Records. And I said, Steve, how can we do this? I don't think he had Exploration Films yet. He had Real Productions.
Yes. Yeah.
And I had Dan Collins Productions. And so I said, let's talk about how we might be able to make this happen.
How did you and Steve first get connected?
Well, we first got connected in 1976. He was with a group called Family before that. I didn't really know who they were. They were part of Youth with a Mission. But three of those people, Ed Ray and his wife, Ray Lynn, and Max Hatfield and Steve, were all connected to, you know, how we, I don't know. I can't even remember how we were connected in that way. But my father-in-law and mother-in-law were writing a musical called If My People.
Yeah.
And that musical was a church musical to bring people back together and have the church pray for the world, for the country, for the governments, for the church. And Jimmy had already done something, Jimmy and Carol, Owens had already done a project called Come Together, which was to unite the church. And that had traveled all over the place and really took off. It was like a fire. And really powerful things began to happen in the church coming together for the first time. And this was all during the Jesus movement, you know, and just how this was all beginning and, you know, all these different connections that God was putting together and putting new ideas and really getting people to recognize, hey, we can do things we've never done before. Let's make this happen. We got denominations everywhere. How about if we get them all together? Let's try to get them all together praying and thinking about this. So that's what If My People was about. So we put together a choir to take on the road. It was based out of Church on the Way in Van Nuys. Jack Hayford was the pastor. And we put together a band and a choir. And we spent about a year putting together booking 40 cities in the United States. Well, Steve was part of that. Second Chapter of Acts was part of that.
Yeah.
Jamie was part of that, my wife. Barry McGuire was part of that for a while. And different people who came together. Actually, I don't know if Barry was on that one. He was on Come Together. He did some of the stuff. Anyway, and so we went on the road and did 40 cities. Well, we're on a bus, you know. And so Steve and I got to know each other pretty well, and we hit it off and became good friends. And later came the, you know, the combination of Second Chapter of Acts and our families to do Live Oak Records. So then we worked together with Live Oak, and, you know, it was just a natural for us to try to work together on this project. And Steve was developing the video side and I was doing the audio side. So it just, it made sense for us to come together and produce this project. So that's basically what happened. And it was not easy getting all these people together. It was pretty difficult.
Really?
After so much time had gone by.
What were some of the logistical difficulties in getting people there?
First of all, who are we going to get? You know, and we were trying to think of the best artists that we knew of that were probably the most well-known. But the criteria was pretty loose. And we knew we could only handle so many people. And we could only bring in, you know, 15 artists at the most. I mean, at that point, how are you going to manage it and how are you going to pay for it? You know, it's like we're bringing everybody to the same place and we're paying for all this stuff and we're trying to make something happen that we've never done before. So it would be really great to make this work. And it logistically, it took about a year and a half, you know, to put it together. Hmm. So, you know, there were some artists that I invited that didn't come, and some of them I really fought for, you know, and said, you got to be there, you know, and some of them came and some of them didn't. So we settled on the amount of people that we had, always in our minds, though, thinking, hey, we'll do another one after this one. If it's successful and we can make it work and people really get on board, let's do another one after that and bring in more artists, you know, the next time and see what happens. Well, you know, it was pricey. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So I tried to get Larry Norman because I'd known Larry for a long time. And Larry was the beginning of a lot of what happened in the Jesus movement in the rock side.
Yeah.
And I really felt like it would be good for him to be there. But he and Randy Stonehill were at odds with each other at the time. And I'd already invited Randy. And when he found out that Randy was going to be there, he said, I just don't think it's going to be good for us to both be there. And I said, well, maybe this is time for you to heal it up. You know, maybe this would be a good opportunity for you guys to really kind of work through this. And we'll all be there together. You know, a lot of artists, you know, and a lot of family. And, you know, we considered ourselves family.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen. You know, I spent about an hour on the phone with him. I really thought maybe he might do it, but I guess I'm not a good salesman. And fortunately, in time, the two of them got sorted out with what they needed to sort out, which was great.
Yeah.
You know, because really that's all that was on my heart. I just wanted to see us all together work, you know, just caring over each other and loving each other and seeing what God could do through, you know, this ministry. And I remember when we all got together up at Forest Home in the mountains here in Southern California, I stood up in front of everybody and just started to cry. It was so good to see everybody. It just overwhelmed me. You know, it was just, here we all are in one place. It was like, because we used to do these, you know, festivals around the country.
Yeah.
And we'd have all of us together and we'd be hanging out and spending time together. And then that would happen. And then another event would happen. And, you know, so getting everybody back together was such a joy for me. I mean, I was just overwhelmed, you know. And so, you know, Steve and I had already set up everything how we were going to do it. I brought in a recording, literally brought in a recording studio and set it up in the lodge.
Yeah.
And Steve brought in all of his camera equipment and all that stuff. And we sat there in that lodge and got everybody there and settled in. But then we had a huge storm come.
That was going to be my next question was, it almost didn't happen because of a massive windstorm from what Steve told me. What was around that?
The day we were supposed to pick up people from, you know, at the airport, people, you know, they were changing flights. You know, they canceled flights. This windstorm was one of the worst Southern California's ever seen. The road getting up to Forest Home was blocked by two trees that fell right across the road. Wow. And we thought, how are we going to get people up here? We had to find another road to get up there, you know, that was way out of the way, but at least we could get people there.
Yeah.
But then we had to get people to drive into LAX to pick people up because the airport in San Bernardino or Ontario, both of those airports were closed. And man, it became really difficult. I mean, we thought for sure it wasn't going to happen, you know, but we did it. It happened. I was hoping, I called Andre Crouch and I said, Andre, you know, I'm telling you, this is what we're going to do. And, you know, he said to me, he said, Dan, no one's ever recorded me or interviewed me and me tell my story. And I said, well, that's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
And he said, I'll be there. And I thought, wow, I was really surprised because, I mean, he was a pastor of a church at that point. I thought he's never going to be able to get away for 3 days, you know, but he did. And he showed up and obviously he's on the video and it was great. We got to record, you know, and one of the things that I wanted to do was to have each artist sing a song that they did from the past and then a new song. So we actually did two or three of each, or maybe sometimes four, and then we picked what we could to get on and get it into the project and make it work. So Steve did a phenomenal job editing. I mean, you know, and doing personal interviews with people, you know. Chuck Gerard actually, with Love Song, his voice disappeared and he literally couldn't sing. And so I said, you're going to have to get up there and you're going to have to pretend you're singing or just whatever comes out of your mouth. And then we'll go back in the studio and we'll dub it in. And that's what I had to do. Had to go back in and match it.
Yeah.
You know, so that was quite an ordeal as well. So we had, you know, a few things like that. We weren't sure how everybody was going to respond or how they were going to react to what we were doing. But, you know, we were really happy with what came out in the end.
Who are some other artists that you really wanted to be there, but that weren't able to make it?
Phil Kagi.
Really?
Yeah, Phil. I called Phil and I had produced his Flipside album. And I called Phil and I told him what we were doing. And he says, Dan, I'd really love to be there, but I am so tired right now. I've been on the road so much. I'm just exhausted. Making another trip and being away from my family for three more days is just like, I don't have the energy right now to do it. I said, okay. And I think I said to him, to try to put a little guilt and shame on him, I said, you're going to be really sorry you didn't do this. I felt bad after I said it, but then I thought, you know what? I'm really trying hard to get him there.
Yeah,
I want him to be there, you know. So in the end, I realized there's a few artists that I've got to connect with. There's other people that we need to connect with. And so Steve and I decided what we'll do is we'll just fly out to different locations.
Yeah.
So I went out to Nashville and I interviewed several different people that I wanted to have on the project. And Steve thought, you know, there's a few other people we need to have too. So let's go do those. So we interviewed Jack Hayford and Pat Boone and we did, you know, and Jimmy and Carol Owens, my in-laws. So we went to locations and added them in. Mm-hmm. So I can't think of anybody else that we asked to come that didn't make it. And I know that we left out some people and later felt kind of bad that we didn't have them there, but I knew we were limited for time and money and, you know, we didn't have what we needed. And I just thought, well, there's going to be some disappointments out there, you know, because there's a lot of people that were part of the Jesus movement that we didn't touch on. But I thought, you know, I'm going to try to get the ones that obviously I have most personal relationship with and see how we can make that happen. So that's really how it all basically came together.
What was the surprise story or performance for you?
That's a good question, because I think I was kind of like so surprised by so much of it that it became as good as it did, that all the artists were really open to tell their stories, that there was more than I knew, you know, that was there. And I think that was such a great blessing to me, was to see how much was there. I pulled together the band, and the band were all guys that I'd worked with, and they did such an amazing job with so many songs that we had to record in just a short period of time.
Yeah.
And it was all live, you know. We didn't touch, I had to touch up a couple things, but just, you know, just minor, you know, literally. And which was really also a blessing because, you know, I'm thinking, how much studio time can we do? You know, I don't want to redo everything. And I didn't. I mean, Matthew's singing on a lav mic and he sang that song, you know, and I'm just like, wow. And it sounded so good. We didn't change a thing. So much of it was just great. It just turned out so good. You know, I think the big surprise for me was when I went to interview Andre Crouch. Steve did some interviews. I did some interviews. We did some together. And the one that happened with Andre was at Andre's church. And I had no idea of his history. So when he told that story about him growing up in Val Verde and his dad taking that church up there and then him playing the piano from nothing, his dad literally said to him, come up here. And he's like 10 years old and he doesn't know, he's never played the piano in his life. And he sits down at the piano and starts to play. It's like, I had no idea that happened. I mean, that was huge. And then as he's telling his story, you know, and how God touched him and he just started crying and then I started crying. And it was one of those things where you just go, what a powerful testimony of God visiting someone, changing their lives, doing things miraculously in them that they couldn't have done themselves.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about Jesus, what I love about God, what I love about his connection with us in this world mm-hmm. is that he does things that we can't do in our lives. And we see things change and we go, wow, that's amazing. So I don't know if there's anything else. I mean, I thought everybody did such a great job. You know, everybody sang well, everybody really reacted well to everything. They were so gracious and they were very generous with their time. And, you know, they just wanted to do it. They just, it was just great. Just great.
Looking back now, 22 years after you guys did this project, which was 30 years after, you know, you had gotten back from Vietnam, basically.
Yeah.
And the whole Jesus movement really started to take off. What lessons can young people today and even future generations glean from? What are the biggest lessons they can glean from your generation and what you guys saw?
You know, it's like me trying to tell somebody about Vietnam. And I can tell them stories about Vietnam, but they never could experience it.
Yeah.
There's no way. And by me telling them the story, it's like watching a movie. And even the story doesn't show them pictures of something, you know? So we can show pictures of something and we can tell stories about things and we can try to bring it to a compelling conclusion. But is there any enduring legacy from that? I don't know. I think from the people who were there and were part of it, they have to do everything they can to tell their story. They can't just let it go away. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we did First Love, one of the reasons, and one of the reasons why God wanted us to do it. But to try to bring something to make it real, I don't know that we can. I think we look at it as history mm-hmm. and we say, this is what God did. And this is what happened. Does it change my life? Maybe, maybe not. Most likely not. Because we have to deal with it on our own, you know, mm-hmm. for what we know and what we're experiencing now. I'm talking about young people, like the millennials. They have to figure out, who am I and what is Jesus all about? And what does he mean to me? And how do I make this work in my life? Is it real? Is it not real? Mm-hmm. You know, is it somebody else's story? I can't live off somebody else's story. I have to live off what God tells me in my heart and what I believe he's telling me and what is real. Okay, I see that happened, but it's very difficult. Like if I tell somebody that there was something that miraculously happened to me, supernatural, something that is not something I created, either people are going to say, you're nuts, or, well, that's interesting that it happened to you. It's never happened to me. Mm-hmm. See, so when I think about that kind of enduring legacy mentality, I never feel like there's anything that really holds on other than if I believe history. It's like, am I going to believe the Bible or not? It's a story. Am I going to believe what really happened? Something's got to happen to me through the work of the Holy Spirit to change me inside. Otherwise, it's a story.
Mm-hmm. Dan Collins, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you being on the Exploration Films podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Exploration Films podcast. To check out this film, you can go to our new streaming service at exploreflix.world. Exploration Films has long been a pioneer and leader in the faith and family film space, and that's why we're so excited to tell you that we've finally launched our own streaming service, exploreflix.world. If you or your family are looking for amazing films, compelling documentaries, unique stories, concerts, and Christian growth resources that all support your Christian worldview, then check out exploreflix.world and get 7 days free. You can go to exploreflix.world. One other quick note, if you like what you hear, please be sure to click subscribe on this podcast app so you'll never miss an episode. For the entire Exploration Films team, I'm Steve Ryder. Thank you for investing your time with us.
That's a wrap.